All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm your host, Ben Domenech. You can email us, as always, at radio@thefederalist.com. I'm happy to be joined today by renowned author, expert, and Hoover Institute fellow, Shelby Steele, who is with me today. Shelby, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
I have been watching with great interest your interviews in the past couple of weeks on television, where you've had enormous insight into what is going on with us as a nation. I am concerned about it for a number of reasons, primarily because I think that the people who we are seeing so active today are folks who have been taught a lot of lies about American history, about the country that we live in, and about the context of what we ought to understand. What do you feel like is going on in our nation today?
Well, my sense is that what's going on today began in the 60s, and that we had a profound, I think, cultural shift at that point, and what's happening today, I think, is an outgrowth of that, a manifestation of it. But in the 60s, America, for the first time, confronted its own capacity for evil. Mm-hmm. And it quite bravely stood up to that and acknowledged it. President Johnson right away turned around and invented every social program conceivable, and America went on a redemptive sort of thrust, I think, since the 60s, so that we Americans could feel innocent of that ugly past. And I think a lot of liberalism that came out of the 60s is simply that sort of redemptive liberalism that tries to for the good, for innocence of the ugly racism and so forth of our past. And where, you know, we have a tension between the left and the right. The right sort of says, well, redemption's nice, but that's, you know, what about the economy and so forth. The left has discovered that there's enormous power in claiming to be redemptive, claiming in putting yourself on the side of the good. And so the left always is constant stream of political correctness sort of do-goodism of one kind or another, and claiming the mantle of power in order to, we will redeem America. We will be the ones who make America achieve its dreams of equity for all and so forth and so on. And they've been extremely effective with that. They've taken over the universities of our country. They've several other institutions it's hard. Even the last few weeks, you see corporate heads, CEOs coming out in support of Black Lives Matter. But what do they know? He's so anxious to be innocent of the past.
Yeah.
And they know that the power to keep doing business, they'll be rewarded rather than punished.
I grew up I was born in Jackson, Mississippi, and I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina, some great southern cities. Mm-hmm. And it is impossible, if you live in cities like that, to not have friendships and relationships that cross the race divide. You'd have to work at it to avoid that. And it really was a shock to me as I became an adult and got older to see the level of tension on a national level that seems to be regularly fomented around race. Why do you think it is that we have reached a point where we nationalize these problems as opposed to, in my opinion, a more accurate perspective, saying, you know, on a national scale, you know, cops are not participating in some kind of hunting down of young unarmed Black men, to say the George Floyd situation, while tragic, is an instance of police brutality that we should all view through that lens as being unacceptable, and reprehensible, but that it does not reflect on, you know, the entire racial relation history of the country that we inhabit.
No, I agree. But there's no power in the position that you're you're describing. If I can say that racism is systemic, and I can expand it in that way, I'm also expanding the entitlement that I claim. Because it's not just one, it's not just George Floyd, this is a pervasive phenomenon in American life, and I need resources adequate to that, and not just one little isolated atrocity.
It has to be all of a piece.
The simplest answer to why we do that is that it's just power. Mm. It's the power that the left hopes Biden will be able to tap into. We'll see, but it's certainly what he's after.
Yeah.
And when you're at, people are after the black vote and so forth, it's same sort of thing. It seems to me power.
Can I ask you, you have a perspective on this. I've been talking to some younger black voices and thinkers in the past couple of weeks.
Younger than me?
Sorry?
Younger than me?
Less experienced than you. It would seem to me that at this moment, at this time in history, in this country, is pretty much the best time to live as someone who is a young minority, particularly, but a young black man specifically. That there's this joke by the comedian Louis C.K. where he says that if you go back in time as a white man, that for most of history, everything's great, but that you should never worry, that's not true of other people. And he says, you never want to go forward as a white man, never go forward. But if you go back, you know, it's always pretty good.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Why? I mean, maybe you disagree and feel free to, but I just feel like, why do we have this perspective on this time in history in which we have all this poll data that says people feel like there's more racial animus than they've ever experienced, even when we know that just on a factual basis, that is not true?
That's a good question. That's certainly true. We know better. I grew up in this completely segregated world in the 40s and the 50s in Chicago, which Martin Luther King labeled the most segregated city in America, and I think he was right on the money. Still is in many ways. But every single aspect of life was segregated. I watched the way in which my father had to live and the people in our world. So I know the progress. I get myself segregation flashbacks. I walk into a hotel lobby in the city and that I can do that. I could actually go in the cafe there and get a hamburger or something. I get a little flashback and marvel at the kind of progress that absolutely nobody thinks about that. If I mention it, they think, you know, I'm crazy or something. But we made it. It's one of the untold stories of modern history, the progress, the moral progress that white America has made since the 50s and the 60s. It is transformed. It's not perfect. Minneapolis reminds us of that. It's racism is still with us, always will be. But my goodness, today you're in Fat City. You're at all talented as a black. You're gonna be just picked up and you're gonna do just fine. Opportunities are everywhere. As I say, the biggest problem black America faces today is freedom. Mm-hmm. We don't have experience with freedom. And it's a profound problem because freedom is a very difficult thing. So you have to really master all sorts of techniques and ways of approaching life itself in order to handle freedom. But that's our problem. Racism is virtually, you can say, virtually completely gone.
I have a
force.
You mentioned a hamburger. A few blocks from where I live, there is a still open a hamburger restaurant that is a vestige of the era in which black restaurants were not allowed to have seating. So it's a standing room restaurant. They're still open. They still serve lunch, and it's the best and greasiest hamburger that you can get in the area. I'm not kidding. The experience, I think, of seeing in the media what we've seen in the past year plus, a depiction of America by the New York Times and the 1619 Project and Nicole Hannah-Jones as being founded in racism, irrevocably tied to racism, irredeemable, as a slave nation that went and fought a revolution to maintain its slave status, that's their frame, even though that's ahistorical, they won a Pulitzer Prize for it. That's a curriculum from the Times that's now going to be spread across the country in public schools. We already feel like, I think a lot of people on the center right and even in the middle of the country feel like there's been a march of radical leftism through a lot of institutions, through Hollywood, through academia. How can we possibly push back when the forces of the largest and most influential media companies and taxpayer dollars through public schools are teaching children that this is a nation founded in racism by racist men that need to be destroyed, need to be knocked down from their platforms?
Well, you touched a lot of subjects there. I'm aware of that project and come out against it. One of the tragedies of the liberalism that came out of the 1960s was that it transformed the black identity itself. When white America began to say, to want redemption, to feel guilt, not in the sense of I'm guilty, but in the sense that there's a liability to being white that there wasn't before. And that's a pressure on whites to be liberal, to create this liberalism that redeems them, that makes them legitimate again. Makes our Johnson as a president couldn't be legitimate until he came up with the war on poverty. And so whites are in that position. That means that blacks are in the position of having that I'm not sure what you'd call it, but a certain weapon that they can squeeze that and say, I have control over your legitimacy now. If I get to arbitrate whether you are a racist or not. And if you are a racist, that redounds to me in power. And so now, you know, blacks may make Biden the next president of the United States. There's power in that. And so one of the tragedies of that is that in order to make that symbiotic relationship work, blacks have to think of themselves as victims of racism their whole lives. It has wiped out it has injured profoundly a great people that we have evolved this identity of victimization. And so we keep here now, the New York Times is of course echoing, they're white and guilty, and so they don't question it at all, this idiocy. They go right along with it. And so as though the smart thing to do is to teach black kids all across the country that if you're authentically black, you're a victim. Mm-hmm. They're killing their own people. It's worse than segregation didn't do that to black people. Black people had higher racial self-esteem then than they do now. So it is this again, this under this symbiotic relationship where both whites are again responding to guilt, they're reacting to what blacks want, and blacks are defining themselves in a way that manipulates power with among whites. So whites, if you say that a black is not a victim, you're racist. Because you're cutting out their means to power. They get upset with me because I say victimization is not remotely our problem anymore. The greatness of Black America is that we overcame it. Mm-hmm. We fought against it for centuries and finally overcame it. So I'm not going to go back and embrace it again. Don't help me because I'm a poor victimized Black. Leave me alone, to quote the great Frederick Douglass.
Why isn't there a statue of Frederick Douglass in every county in America?
I have no idea. He is Frederick Douglass is my liberator.
A man's rights rest in the voting box, the jury box, and the cartridge box. I am disappointed, profoundly disappointed, to see the ahistorical nature of some of the responses that have been made in the wake of this uproar that have tried to loop in virtually every grievance that the radical left has when it comes to honoring figures from our past. We can obviously have open debates, and I, you know, am one who is, you know, not in favor of having, you know, statues of Jefferson Davis and capitals and things like that. But we can have debates about that aspect. What I did not expect was to see so rapidly debates about statues of Winston Churchill, of Abraham Lincoln, of Gandhi this morning was getting some flack from the BBC. The statue that was torn down of Christopher Columbus in Minneapolis, which was made by an Italian immigrant who basically lived the American dream, is the sort of thing that I just feel like is really ahistorical and has nothing to do with George Floyd or police brutality. What can one say, though, when the radical left, the mob, is engaged in this kind of activity to slow what they're doing? Because they seem to be the ones who are being aggressive, who are just doing what they want, while other folks are sort of sitting back too scared to weigh in because they feel like they'll be accused of being a racist.
Well, you named it. I blame them now more than I do the people who want to tear down all the statues. Where is the opposition?
Yeah.
Why are you? Well, I have a theory or two about that, but
tell me, go ahead.
Well, again, I think they're stunned. First of all, I'm much bothered by this idea that we tear down these statues and so forth. They're a part of American history. I'm Black. I want to see them. I want to know that was real. That war took place. There was a Confederacy. They believed in slavery. I want to see all of that. The world's not about my feelings. I want to absorb it all. I want to be informed by it, mm-hmm. and develop my own sense of beliefs in relation to what really happened, what really was there. Don't touch those statues. They're probably more meaningful for me than the ones that I agree with. And I'm proud, I'm gonna learn more from them. So here's the irony. Fourth grade Black children today in America can barely read. Very few of them can get to the point where they read. In California, 75% of the Black boys who graduate from high school are reading at an eighth grade level. I mean, on and on. Now, that's a problem.
Yeah.
That's a racial problem. That's all kinds of problems. Whether some statue is somewhere is ridiculous. What this whole focus on symbols makes a point that points to what I think is a major corruption in the liberalism that came out of the 60s. which is that identity is agency. Mm-hmm. Identity is power, is the, and so if I can really be filled with my sense of blackness, I will be a more powerful figure in the world. So I should enrich my identity. That's the way into the future. That's the way to power. The problem is that identity is not an agent.
Yeah.
It's a passive thing. You can put all you want in it. It's never going to do a damn thing for you. You can, blackness is a joke in terms of getting things done. It doesn't, it's not an agent. It doesn't change the world. It's an after the fact sort of reality. But again, it's used by the left and as an illusion that motivates people. And there's, again, another trick, easy way out of the real work of why don't we fix the problem that these fourth graders can't read? That's what I want to see. The real problems are screaming at us. We ignore them and pretend that our identity is going to do. All we need to do is teach them their identity. And then, so then they get deeply confused and still can't read. It's a tragedy.
Where'd you grow up in Chicago?
I grew up just off the south side, little black suburb called Phoenix, Illinois. It was the 268 suburbs of Chicago. It was 267th in terms of wealth.
So you still have friends there?
Pardon? I do know a few people there, yeah, but most of the people I knew were long gone. Many did very well.
Seeing the coverage or the lack thereof of this most violent weekend that they've experienced in 60 years infuriated me. I read a piece that went through the shootings that happened, and it was just, you know, 10 minutes later, six blocks away, you know, this person shot in a car, that kind of thing, over and over again. Black male, age 32, black male, age 29, black male, age 34. To me, I mean, that's as big of a travesty as George Floyd is, and it is a travesty. Police brutality is a travesty. The officer should be punished. You know, we should go through the system of justice. It's a much bigger travesty to me that something like that is not national news, is not on the front page of every newspaper, that people aren't demanding for changes in leadership. Why do we have a perspective on this that ignores the shootings of more than 80 people, the deaths of more than 20 people, mostly, you know, within the black community, in a way that puts political correctness in front of saying what's actually going on in one of America's great cities?
That is a very good question. I've been harping on that for a long time. the numbers are just staggering. And I kind of, at this point, sometimes wonder if there are any kids left to shoot on the South Side. I've just spent a little time there and talking to some, just on the street talked to one kid who's 18 years old, he has two children of his own. He has no education at all. He's never been to downtown Chicago. Never seen it. It's about 3 miles away, up the South Side. Who do we blame that on? And this is there's a whole political way to look at that, and white guilt, of course, will never really address it because, as you say, they don't feel they have the moral authority to speak about it. That's a problem that only black people can fix. And the only way they can fix that is to begin to focus on family, on marriage. You can't keep having children. When you're 20 years old, you got three or four children, no, all different fathers. What social program is going to fix that? Mm-hmm. Again, I'm writing something about this recently, but I grew up in the 50s, 60s, same neighborhoods, full of gangs and so forth. When I was there, everybody had a daddy. Maybe he wasn't the greatest in the world, but he was there. And everybody was, there were certain formal manners you had to have when you were past adults. You nodded, you said, sir and ma'am, there was a sense of community. We were all dirt poor. Today, I know one kid there from two blocks away from my house that owns two or three department stores in Houston. Another Melvin Van Peebles who invented independent filmmaking in America. There are some fabulous people who came out of that. All just had regular family life. We don't have family life anymore. Mm-hmm. Black women get married at half the rate of white women. They get divorced at twice the rate. There's nothing you can do to fix that. And yeah. So then the kid is 8, 9, 10 years old, and his buddy shows him a pistol. And it's glamorous. And it's more definitive than his mother or than any adult he knows. He can kill. Mm. And you mess with me, Al, that it, you just see this sort of disintegration, this melting down of the human condition. Down to a level where you're really almost at a nihilistic level, where things have no meaning. There's no hierarchies of meaning. You're just, I want those shoes, and so I'll kill you. When you looked at that girl I like, I'll kill you. I want to see liberalism deal with that.
Yeah.
I want to see all the people who are so worried about, 1619 and victimization and all. It wasn't that bad in slavery. There wasn't this level of nihilism. And so it's much worse than people realize. We have a underclass now. There was no underclass when I grew up. None. There were poor people. Everybody worked. Everybody had a dream, even when it made no sense. I couldn't be a paper boy because white people wouldn't have black boys riding to the neighborhood at 6 a.m. So I couldn't have a paper route. Well, that's an absurdity, but everywhere you went, it was like that. We still had to find a way to make a few cents. And we did. I got jobs picking vegetables, all sorts of things. When it was left to us. Today, the institution, the government and so forth, and all these institutions are going to relieve you of that. Don't relieve me of that. That's life. Let me have my life. Please leave us alone. It's my get up every morning. You're going to leave us alone today.
What do you think when you see, as happens so often in these incidents, Al Sharpton show up, give his spiel about justice, and then get back on that nice jet that he has?
I know Al Sharpton. Just interviewed him a couple of months ago. May again soon. Al is Al's not the phenomenon. The phenomenon is the world that the symbiosis that keeps him going. Mm-hmm. The idea of black victims and white racists. That's that sort of structure of the world. It's just, if it wasn't Reverend Al, it'd be somebody else. It was Jesse Jackson who was the greatest.
Yeah.
I think of all time. He certainly made the most money from it.
Gotta admire the hustle.
we deal with the world we're born into, Jesse was an enormously talented man, but he didn't have the character of King. And he couldn't pass that money up. King could, but Jesse couldn't, and I think that's why his legacy is a bit tarnished. But he had talent. And this is the sad thing in the post-60s America, is that it encourages this. Whites are so guilty. Mm-hmm. And so wealthy. George Soros is, sends millions down to Ferguson to keep the riots going. There's money everywhere to keep this corruption going. because black people are, they're worth something. There's some power there. You can use them. And so I blame us for putting ourselves into their hands, and not we didn't finish the job of winning our own self-possession. You have to possess yourself. You have to own yourself, and you have to have some integrity about that, and you have to the point where you're willing to die. Where you're willing to, you know, Patrick Henry's my favorite guy. Liberty or death? Well, it's not liberty if I have to come out now and pay homage to whatever institution I belong to and pretend to be an alienated black who's victimized. How's that an improvement?
I know your time is limited, so let's go out on this. I know that across the country right now, there are a lot of white Americans who feel paralyzed by the moment. They don't think of themselves as racist. They don't believe that they're racist. They certainly, you know, had the revulsion that I think all of us had to the Floyd video. And yet they're being put in this position where they're being told, unless you get on your knees, unless you go along with this radical agenda, unless you post hashtag defund the police, unless you don't criticize people for rioting or destroying property, then you're not really an ally. You know, in fact, that's an indication that you are a racist and an irredeemable one. What would you say to them in this moment about what their attitude ought to be and how they ought to respond to that kind of pressure that they're getting? Maybe not organically, but certainly from the world of celebrity and the world of corporate America.
It's like anything else. I think that's a good statement of the problem. I think that somehow nothing will change until white Americans somehow develop a moral confidence in them, in their own decency, in their own, and stop feeling vulnerable, and oh, because as long as they feel vulnerable, which they do now, they're going to be had. Minorities are going to come after them. Everybody, the left is going to come after them, and they're going to be reeling back, and that's what's been going on now for 50 years. I don't think anything in race relations is going to really improve until white Americans find their moral confidence and have the courage. I'm exactly in the same position they're in, so I know where a little bit whereof I speak. I speak out against the idea of victimization and this whole symbiosis that we've been talking about, and I'm called from day in and day out, an Uncle Tom, a coon, I can remember all the names, but I don't choose to. I'd rather live with that than live as I know so many other people have just sort of shut up and said the way that for me is to not push the river here and just roll with it. Well, problems are solvable when people find the courage to do it. We have, we in America today, particularly our left, haven't, and on the political right, we've sort of been flat-footed, dumbfounded, and oh my God, we'll point up the obvious contradictions all day long. But the solutions, the actual real solutions, you're talking about that fourth grader who can't read, teach reading. It's not complicated, but you have the courage. You have to have the courage to say his problem is reading, and let's fix that. That's easy to fix. Things will change when people find the courage to make them change.
Shelby Steele, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.